This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. The United Nations decided earlier this week not to ban all forms of human cloning, leaving the door open to therapeutic cloning, which uses stem cells gathered from human embryo clones to treat diseases. And for someone suffering from Parkinson's disease or diabetes, stem cells may one day be a cure, a way to replace the failing cells that are causing the disease. For other people, stem cells are a moral problem because they feel that human embryos, even when they are composed of a handful of cells, are still human life. Among scientists, the term stem cells has different meanings. There are embryonic stem cells, adult stem cells, and the stem cells that are transplanted into leukemia or lymphoma patients. And there's confusion about just how many lines of stem cells are available to scientists to work with using federal funds. Just over 2 years ago, the president, President Bush, put the number at about 60 or so. But that would be hard-pressed to find researchers who agree with that figure today or even come close to it. Confused about stem cell research? Well, this hour we'll help try to make sense of this sometimes complicated and controversial field. We're broadcasting from the Science Museum of Minnesota, located on the shores of the Mississippi in beautiful downtown St. Paul. And if you have questions about stem cells, we invite you to step up to one of our microphones here at the Science Museum, or if you're listening on the radio or on the internet, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Catherine Verfaillie is the director of the Stem Cell Institute and professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ryan.
You're welcome. Dan Kaufman is an assistant professor at the Stem Cell Institute and in the Department of Medicine at the University of Minnesota. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Kaufman.
Thanks for having me.
Stanimir Vukpavlovich is the director of the Stem Cell Laboratory and professor of biochemistry and molecular biology at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine in Rochester, Minnesota. Thank you for being with us today.
Nice being here.
And joining us on the telephone from Ann Arbor is Jeff Kahn, who is normally here in Minnesota at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Minnesota. He's director of the center, but he joins us today from Michigan. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Kahn.
Good to be here.
Let's talk about the different things. Dan Kaufman, whenever I talk to people about stem cells, they always mix in stem cells and cloning all the time. I find people are very, very confused about the two. Can you straighten that out for us?
Well, yeah, I think that is a common confusion that the topics are often mixed together, but they're actually two quite distinct areas. That stem cells encompasses a broad variety of cells, including adult stem cells, embryonic stem cells, blood stem cells, muscle stem cells, and so on. Cloning refers to the process of what's more technically described as somatic cell nuclear transfer, where you take the nucleus of one cell, put it into an egg, and try and derive blastocysts or embryos or animals from that, which has been done. One small aspect of cloning is the potential to derive embryonic stem cells from those cloned embryos. And some people have thought of that as a strategy to derive matched stem cells for mm-hmm. therapies. But again, it's only one small aspect of the whole field, and it helps cause some controversy and confusion over the whole area.
And you mentioned the different kinds of stem cells there are, and you focus on the human embryonic stem cell research, correct?
That's right.
Tell us what diseases might embryonic stem cells one day possibly be used to treat?
Well, I think a lot of the interest and efforts for a wide variety of stem cells, both embryonic and adult, have some of the same potential to better understand and treat diseases like my interest is in blood diseases and cancer, things like leukemia or myeloma. The list often includes diabetes or Parkinson's disease or spinal cord trauma disorders mm-hmm. Or other neurodegenerative disorders. I think what's lost in a lot of this is that by studying the various types of stem cells, embryonic stem cells in adults, and learning how parts of the body normally grow and develop, a lot of the therapies and a lot of the medicine that might be derived might not be directly from the stem cells themselves, but they might be used from the knowledge that's gained from studying these and making other existing systems work better as well.
Dr. Verfaya, you work on adult stem cells. Are there more than one type of adult stem cell?
Adult stem cells exist in a lot of different tissues. The best well-studied is the blood stem cell that is being used currently for the last 30 years or so for therapy of patients with cancer or blood diseases. More recently, there's been stem cells identified, for instance, in the brain, in the skin, in the eyes. And then there is, over the last several years, also some evidence that suggests that some of these adult stem cells may actually have characteristics that are a little bit more like embryonic stem cells, even though it's too early to say how close these two cell populations actually are.
In fact, you identified one stem cell called the MAPC. Tell us about it. Last time you were on Science Friday, you talked about that.
Yeah, so we identified, sort of by accident in the laboratory, a cell that is present in the bone marrow of humans and mice and rats, and probably also in other tissues. And that cell appears to have some properties that are commonly associated with embryonic stem cells in the sense that they seem to be able to grow for a long period of time in the laboratory without obvious signs of aging, and that even though they come from the bone marrow, they appear to be able to be morphed into cells that look like liver or cells that look like brain and function like brain, at least in culture dishes. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Vuk Pavlovich, tell us about your line of work. So you work with them stem cells that are a bit further down the line, correct?
Yeah, what we do at the Mayo Clinic in my program is essentially somewhat different from a different point of view than Dr. Verfaya and Kaufman do. And that is what essentially we do is we take a scientific observation, either ours or maybe Dr. Verfaya's or anyone else's, and try to take that observation into a therapeutic agent that will be tested in a clinical trial. So essentially what we do is turning science into technology, observing all the ethical, technological, and regulatory conditions that we have to pay attention to.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about stem cells this hour, and it's a good opportunity for you in the audience. If you have any questions about that stem cell research, we've got the top people in the field sitting here, also people on the phone with us. Also, if you're on the telephone, you can all get your questions ready. Let me, Jeff Kahn, that UN decision this week that actually was made yesterday, they voted not to ban therapeutic cloning, at least for now. What's your reaction to that?
It's an interesting time in stem cell policymaking around the world. I think the first thing we should say is that the UN doesn't have authority to ban or restrict anything on its own. Its member countries can go back after voting for such a policy and then make policy in their own countries or pass laws, but the UN itself doesn't have that authority. And what happened yesterday really represents a rift in the UN. It was almost equally divided between those countries that wanted a total ban on cloning of human embryos for any purpose, whether it be for reproduction or for research or therapeutic purposes, on one hand. And the United States was on the side of a total ban against another equal number of countries who wanted to draw a line between reproductive cloning and so-called therapeutic or research cloning. And so they couldn't agree on which approach to take, so rather than vote, they just decided to put off until 2005 any decision. But that doesn't mean that countries around the world can't make their own policy at this time or between now and then.
Why are they having such a difficult... I looked at the vote. It was split almost 50-50. I think there was one vote that decided the issue.
I think 80 to 79 was the number.
Yeah. What is the problem they're wrestling with?
Well, the problem is really about whether a total ban is the way that countries want to go, that is not allowing cloning of embryos, period, human embryos, that is. Both policies excluded cloning of animals. That would be allowed according to the laws of member countries. But the ban that was being discussed was between the total cloning or ban of cloning as a matter of any cloning at all versus allowing cloning to go forward for research purposes but banning it for reproduction. And so that's really where the distinction is. It's countries are lining up on either side of that very bright line between a total ban and a reproductive ban only. The interesting thing is the bedfellows. There were, I think, 57 countries in the Islamic bloc that were actually proposing that there be a ban only on reproductive cloning, not on therapeutic or research cloning. and the U.S. was in the bloc that was hoping for a total ban. So I think it's not shaking out in quite the way people might have expected in terms of which countries would go which way.
That is very interesting. 1-800-989-8255. Let's get some calls from listeners here and also hopefully from the audience. Fran in Syracuse, New York. You're up first. Hi, Fran.
Hi, how are you today?
Hi, go ahead.
My question had to do with how is it that stem cell research got tied so tightly to the abortion debate when we can extract live stem cells from every umbilical cord birth and we could pay the parents and defer their costs and you'd still have the stem cells available for research?
Anybody want it? Dr. Khan, you want to pick up that hot potato?
I sure can, and I think my colleagues sitting there with you in St. Paul can do a better job of explaining the science. But the answer is the cells that come from a cord blood are not the same as the cells that are extracted from a human embryo. And so I think the caller would be absolutely right. If the same kinds of cells could be collected from cord blood as can be derived from embryos. And the truth is we just don't know whether that's the case yet. And that's why there's the controversy about what kinds of use are appropriate. I think in terms of answering the question about why it gets tied to the abortion debate is because, as in your intro, you mentioned some people have the attitude that human embryos have the same moral status as you or I do. And if you believe that, if you think that the moral status of an embryo is the same as a born person, then of course you wouldn't think it was appropriate to use embryos for research. The fact is there's a wide range of beliefs in answer to that question, everything from the sense that that human embryos have the moral status of full-grown people, all the way through to the idea and the belief that human embryos have no different moral status than the cells you can scrape out of the inside of your cheek. They're just a collection of cells. I think by and large people lie somewhere in between that. The majority view is in between this sense that embryos are like people and embryos are just a cluster of cells. And that ties closely to the abortion debate in the sense that the cases over the course of years since Roe v. Wade in 1973 have said the state does have a compelling interest in protecting potential human life, but that can be trumped or overtaken by other equally or more important moral values like the protection of the privacy rights of women to make decisions about their body. And so we can say that there are important moral considerations in doing the research that might trump this idea of the moral status of human embryos. And the difficulty is trying to figure out what the answer to that is. Where is the right place to draw the line? What are sufficient justifications for using embryos in research?
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Dr. Verfai, your MAPC stem cells seem to be so flexible or fluid that they might they not take the place of what some of the embryonic stem cells do? They're adult stem cells, correct?
So they are derived from individuals or animals that were born. You know, they're more frequent in young animals or young individuals than older individuals, but they do appear to be present. How flexible are they? Well, I don't know that we have the answer today that they are as flexible as embryonic stem cells. There's for sure significant differences between the two cell populations, and it's, for instance, still very difficult for us to take these adult MAPC cells and have them become beating heart muscle cells, which is a very easy thing to do with embryonic stem cells. So the reason that at the university here, we actually recruited my colleague who sits to the right side of me here, Dr. Kaufman, is to actually be in a position such that we can start asking the question, you know, if you now take a disease, heart disease, Parkinson's, diabetes, and we want to come up with a therapy in the next 5 or 10 years using cells, will we need embryonic stem cells? Can adult stem cells do the trick? And, you know, what cell actually will ultimately be the right cell to use? And I don't think we have the answer today. So I think it is too early to say, based on the research that we have done, that embryonic stem cell research should not be done because there's an alternative for it.
All right, we're going to talk about lots more about embryonic stem cells, adult stem cells. Take your questions about stem cells in general when we return after this break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about stem cells. It's our stem cell update, and there's always so much to talk about. We have to continually update where we are. My guests are Catherine Verfai, Director of the Stem Cell Institute and Professor of Medicine at the University of Minnesota, Dan Kaufman, Assistant Professor at the Stem Cell Institute, also at the University of Minnesota, And Stanimir Vukpavlovic, director of the Stem Cell Laboratory, professor of biochemistry and molecular biology at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine in Rochester, Minnesota. Jeff Kahn, director of the Center for Bioethics, University of Minnesota. And you can hear from, probably guess from that introduction, that we are in Minnesota, in St. Paul, at the Science Museum of Minnesota this hour. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Ethan in Davis, California. Hi, Ethan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a substitute teacher, and I wanted to talk a little bit about one of the experiences that I had. I used to teach in Monterey Peninsula School District, and I actually got in trouble when I had a student ask me about stem cell research. And so I gave them the information they asked me. I didn't think it was that big of a deal. Well, one of the students went home and told their parents, and I got in trouble for talking about it.
You got in trouble for talking about stem cells in class?
Yeah, I got in trouble. The school district told me that that I wasn't really supposed to talk about that kind of thing, and if parents objected to it, then I needed to keep that kind of thing to myself, especially with a hot-button political issue. But the thing that actually this is a kind of an overwhelming trend that I've noticed is that opponents to stem cell research tend to try to obfuscate the issue and keep people ignorant as to what it actually is. And anybody who tries to shed light on it is pretty much kept quiet. You know, especially like the people who really want to know, like kids. I also want to respond to one of your guests previous. I heard him constantly using the word embryo, and I just want to make sure that I'm on the right track here, that embryo, he means a blastocyst.
Okay, let me get a reaction. Anybody want to react to the school situation? Or is Jeff Kahn going to jump in on that hot potato again because he's not here?
It's always me, huh?
Well, you are the ethicist here, so...
I'm happy to take the bait, and my colleagues can think while I talk. I think that the problem, or one of the problems, is that we need good information to be making good decisions. It's like anything else. You can only come to bad ethical judgments if you don't have good facts. And so it's, I think, critically important that certainly kids who are asking be given good information about what we're talking about in stem cell research. I talk a lot to high school classes, and inevitably I'll get a question about why not use just cord blood. And it's a fair question, but I think it's because they don't understand the distinction between the kinds of cells that may be in human umbilical cord blood and the kinds of cells that can be derived from human blastocysts. Ethan is right. I tend to use embryos as a more generic term, but technically speaking, from the developmental biology perspective, they're at the blastocyst level. Mm-hmm. So I think it's critically important for kids in school. It's critically important for our policymakers to have good information. And there's a lot of debate about whether good information is flowing through the entire process by which we make decisions as a matter of public policy in the area of stem cell research.
I completely agree with that. And the thing that really gets me is the fact that the people who are against it want to keep people thinking that stem cell research is essentially babies in blenders, which it's not. And, you know, that's my objection to it, is that obfuscation and the perpetuation of ignorance. And, yeah, anyway. So.
Right. Okay, Ethan, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. Dr. Vukpavlovic, maybe we need more scientists like you and our panelists to speak up when they're asked about stem cell research.
Yeah, I was just thinking about this conversation that just took place. There is a misconception, I think, that scientists are trying to make some monsters to the Frankenstein comes to mind. Actually, the goal of all this work is to learn how cells develop from a less mature into more mature and how they differentiate. And unless we study these systems, we will never learn. And once we learn, the goal would not be to... cellular therapy is a crude therapy, a transplantation. We don't want to do that if we have anything better. And what would be better? Better would be small molecules, drugs like aspirin or any other, that would specifically turn on and off genes and drive cells, either our own that went into the wrong direction or someone else's, into what we need to regenerate function that the patient lost.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Martin in Indianapolis. Hi, Martin.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Hi. Go ahead.
I'm curious about the number of cell lines that are out there that, you know, is there enough critical mass of cell lines available in the United States for scientists to stay engaged and continue the research, or do they have to look outside the United States, and are we in danger of kind of a brain drain of this important technology?
Good question. When I asked some leading researchers about how many stem cell lines were available from the 60 that they were talking about, I got numbers ranging from 3 to 6. I mean, is that, Dr. Verfaay, is that accurate?
I think it's accurate. It's probably 6 or 7, and Dan probably knows better, but I think there are 6 or 7 of the cell lines of the 60 that were on the NIH list to be approved for use with NIH money in the United States. So they're actually...
Is that enough for research?
I think for some of the questions that need to be asked, it might be enough, but I think that some of the newer cell lines that are being developed here in this country as well as elsewhere may actually be quite superior to the initial cell lines, but Dan Kaufman may actually have more insights on that particular
Take it
topic.
Away, Dan.
Yeah. Well, as far as the exact number of cell lines that are available, it's actually continually updated on an NIH website. If you go to their homepage, they have a link to the stem
That's
cell
the official,
registry.
The official version.
That will tell you which ones are being distributed. So there were originally about 60 or 70 that were potential cell lines. The ones that are actually being distributed from places like Wisconsin, San Francisco, Australia, are on that site, and it'll tell you how well they're characterized. And there's probably between 6 and 10. Mm-hmm. South Korea now has approved cell lines. I think Sweden now has approved cell lines. So you can tell that this is getting widely internationalized. And those are all on the so-called approved, federally approved cell lines that were are eligible for NIH funding. There are new cell lines that are being derived either within this country or outside this country that will not be available for federally funded research in this country. And right now, I usually say it's a matter of good news, bad news. We do have cell lines available, and we can get some federal funding for that. And for the next few years, that's probably good to get this research going. Once this really starts to escalate, we're going to ask more and more questions and more sophisticated questions and want to have new cell lines that might have more genetic diversity or may have other characteristics that are more suitable. And mm-hmm. then we're going to run into a question of funding and such for that.
Dr. Vuk Pavlovich?
Yeah. Personally, I don't really understand why this focus on cell lines. I think that the only thing that should be regulated is conception for the purpose of getting cells. Unfortunately, or however we want to characterize it, there is a lot of embryonal and fetal material out there without that. And I just don't see any ethical difference between one cell line and a zillion cell lines. It's the same thing. So the question is that I can understand that so many people are concerned about is conceiving for the purpose of getting cell line.
So then are you all in agreement that this number of approved cell lines is irrelevant to the research? Because people may be using other sources that are not, quote, officially approved in
doing
the research?
Even embryonic cell lines, the more conceivably the better, because there is a lot of statistics that gets into that and genetics and so on. But as I said, ethically, one cell line or a million cell lines is the same thing. And if we can get enough fetal and embryonal material without anything that would anyone consider unethical.
Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
If I was a graduate student and I wanted to do some embryonic cell research, and there were a lot more lines available outside the United States, I might consider going to graduate school someplace else. And, I'm a little concerned that the core of this research is going to move outside of the United States.
No, just go to Dr. Verfaay. You'll do well.
Dr. Verfaay, you follow that too?
But I think currently in the United States, you can actually use all the cell lines that are being made in the world. The only thing you can't do is use federal funds for it, but you can obtain funds from other organizations to do work with the embryonal stem cells that are not designated as being approved for funding by the NIH.
And what percentage of all the work done do you think is being done in that direction without the approval, using the funds that are not approved?
Well, there's multiple institutions that have funding through Howard Hughes or the Juvenile Diabetes Research Fund or some of the other foundations where funds are being used within the United States to either generate new cell lines from leftover IVF blastocysts or to use cell lines that were made in other countries that weren't on the initial list approved by the president.
Dr. Khan, do you want to jump in here?
I do. You know, it's an interesting way to draw the line, and I think the idea that there's an ethical difference between cell lines that were created before August the 9th of 2001 and those that were created afterwards is really just a way to sort of draw a political line, not an ethical line. And so that 60 or 72 or whatever the number is that's on the website as it continues to grow were the numbers of cell lines that were identified as of 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on August the 9th, 2001. And the argument was no new embryos will be destroyed for cell lines with public money. And the question is whether that's the proper way to draw the line or whether we say we have many hundreds of thousands of embryos that were created using IVF for reproduction but aren't going to be used to have children anymore and will potentially be discarded. Why not use those? Why not draw the line at the use of those so-called spare embryos rather than the cell lines that existed as of August 2001? And I think that while Catherine is right that there's private funding to fund research that's on the unapproved cell lines, the fact is that basic science is by and large driven by public monies. And we are talking about basic science. So there's no way that private money can really ever replace the NIH and other kinds of public funders in this kind of basic research. And I think evidence of that, that there is research going on outside the U.S. that probably would otherwise go on here, is a recent announcement that the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation is working with the government of Singapore to spend upwards of $5 million on some stem cell research that would not be approvable with at least public money in the U.S. So I think that there is some effect on the funding decision, which is really staked to a day on the calendar rather than to some other kind of moral line drawing.
That also limits any products that might be made from stem cells made without those approved cells, right? You could not bring them into the United States or use them.
So I don't think that's the case. I think that as long as the FDA were to approve their use, then it would be okay. And the way that would be paid for is likely with private dollars, and so the proceeds from the sale of those therapies would be private. So you'd have less access, I would guess, but I don't know that it would be illegal.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to this gentleman at the microphone. Yes, sir.
A question about current application of stem cells in therapy. A family member, as part of her treatment for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, received what I believe is called an autologous stem cell transplant. I'm wondering how long it's been around, how common it is, et cetera.
Dr. Kaufman?
Yeah? What the question refers to is what are considered bone marrow transplants or hematopoietic cell transplants, and that therapy has actually been around for a little over 30 years now. And it's often news to people that we've actually been doing stem cell-based therapy for 30 years. For primarily treatment of hematologic malignancies, blood cancers like lymphoma, leukemia, myeloma, and they come in two forms. The autologous transplant, like the question referred to, was using your own blood stem cells as a part of the treatment regimen, and there's also allogeneic transplants where you use donated cells from another person, often a sibling, though there can also be done with unrelated donors. As a way to potentially treat and cure these types of cancers. And so we know this type of stem cell therapy works, and we're seeking now to advance that.
We're talking this hour about stem cell research on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's go to the phones, and then we'll go back to the floor here. Let's see. There's so many people want to talk about it. Let's go to Rosie in Tucson. Hi, Rosie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Stem cell research is present in my mind as a hope for my son who was diagnosed with juvenile diabetes at the age of 2. And I saved his cord blood when he was born. And my question is, how realistic am I being thinking that his cure is going to come from that, from his stem cells, his own stem cells?
Dr. Vuk Pavlovich?
Yeah, that's a common, in my view, misconception that's a good idea. You would give your son the same cells or their predecessors that essentially brought to the disease potentially. So the use of cells from umbilical cord blood is probably a much better idea to create large banks to allow those groups, particularly those ethnic and genetic groups that have a very small chance of finding a matched stem cell that there is a pool of cells for them that they could provide a better chance to find a match. Usually there is very little scientific basis for saving someone's cells so that one day that person would be saved by them.
Is that because they just won't work? They have no better chance? People think it's my cells, I'll bank them.
Yes, but it's those cells that actually developed cancer. So yeah. Would you
want Why to do you want to back? Save the bad cells?
That's one thing. The other thing is that technically we do not have proper technical experience with freezing those cells and keeping them for 50, 60 years. Those technologies just haven't been there. And we do not know. We know there is something that's known as low temperature denaturation. In other words, deteriorating even at these cryogenic temperatures. We just don't know enough. And it makes sense to provide those bloods for those who have a very small chance of finding that. I would rather look for my child into such a large bank where the chance is good than keep the cells for 50, 60, or 70 years, or even 2 years.
Okay, Rosie?
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about stem cell research this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. A few more questions before the break. Yes, sir.
Yeah, two questions. First, very quickly, could human cadavers or corpses be used for the research? And that's for the panel here. And then a question for Dr. Khan, which is this. The Economist magazine talked in a story about how the embryonic cloning issues are going to largely be overshadowed in time by a lot of the neurotechnology research being done at the level of brain computer interfaces and things like that. And so here's my question, which is this, is that perhaps the larger question in a lot of the embryonic research is an ethical, moral one that people are having over how to define the human and what constitutes either the natural human or just what is the human in a sense. And I'd welcome your comments on that as well.
I've got 30 seconds for the question. It took longer to ask that answer. Yeah. Dr. Rafai, you want to quickly give me a 30-second answer? We'll come back to it after the break. Okay.
Regarding stem cells in dead individuals and corpses, you can actually collect stem cells for blood transplantation or other sources from corpses. Whether these cells can also be used to treat all other kinds of diseases like Parkinson's and diabetes, I don't think any studies really have been done. So I don't think we really have the answer on that question.
All right, we'll come back part two after this break. So everybody hold their breath and think of your own answer. We'll see if it matches ours. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're coming to you from St. Paul, Minnesota, from the Science Museum here. Number 1-800-989-8255. We're talking this hour about stem cell research with my guests, Catherine Verfey of the University of Minnesota, Dan Kaufman, also at the University of Minnesota, Stanimir Vuk Pavlovich for the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine, and Jeff Kahn, the University of Minnesota. Our number 1-800-989-8255. And before I rudely interrupted our questioner, he was asking a question about whether, he wanted to know whether our panelists thought that perhaps since there's been progression in neuronal interfaces with computers, they may overtake the need to use stem cell research in curing some of the illnesses that maybe computer interface types of things might. Is that about what you were saying? I guess that's close enough. Well, it's not close enough. He's going to give us a little shorter version of that.
Very, very quickly, all I meant was that the ethical debate that has been enlarged by questions about cloning and embryonic research are going to be overshadowed, perhaps, in another series of debates about what it is between that machine-human fusion and things like that. But they're indicative of what may be coming. That's all I was asking about.
No wonder we're college crowd here, I can tell. What do you think? What do you think, Dr. Vuk Pavlovich?
Yeah, I think that we should try to delimit the science fiction and reality. Reality in stem cell application is that we have only one that is really standard, and that's, as my colleagues alluded to, bone marrow transplantation or hematopoietic blood-forming stem cell transplantation. And even that is not a definitive therapy. These cells are used in most cases really to offset the lethal effects of other therapies like chemotherapy and radiation therapy. And just another note of caution, historically, new treatments in cancer and usually required 25 years from the basic observation that's very often ridiculed to the standard of care. That happened with chemotherapy, that happened with monoclonal antibodies and others. So conceptually, as I used to say, stem cells and these technologies are probably in conceptual year 2 or 3. So we have a long, long way to go when the real ethical issues in applying these to humans as a standard of care becomes a real problem.
Dan Kaufman, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal earlier this week that said predicted there'll be clinical trials of stem cell therapy within 5 years. Do you agree with that?
That's referring to use of embryonic stem cell-based therapies within 5 years. I think as far as starting therapies, it might be realistic in 5 years for certain diseases. Probably where this is going to show up first is for Parkinson's disease, where some have shown that you can derive neurons from human ES cells, and they're in the process of showing function of those neurons. Parkinson's disease is probably amenable for this because other types of transplants, such as using fetal tissue, have been done for Parkinson's disease. The results have been mixed, but at least the systems are there to allow these types of trials to go forward if you have enough cells. And the whole idea of using the human ES cells is as a new source to derive more cells for these types of therapies.
A couple of years ago, we had a woman from Harvard. I can't remember her name, who it was now, because I just having one of my senior moments. But she was a researcher with pancreatic cells, and she discovered that by accident, she was trying to do some research with stem cells and rejuvenate these pancreatic cells, that if she knocked out the pancreatic cells first so that she could replace them, they would replace themselves. There were stem cells floating around in the system, and the problem was not replacing the cells, because the cells would rejuvenate, the stem cells would rejuvenate the system, but finding the cause that was continually to kill the cells, because it didn't matter if you put them back in, they would be killed one more time. And that seemed to be a problem. If you do find a treatment, but you don't find the actual cause, that you might, you know, the treatment might fail, even if you're successful with the patient?
Well, I think that's one of the hurdles that has to be overcome, and that has to be the immune system that could reject any transplanted cells. And it's true now, whether you do organs like kidneys or hearts or bone marrow other stem cell-derived therapies. If you're talking about, again, autologous therapies, more like the adult stem cells that Catherine works on, that if it is an autoimmune disease like mm-hmm. diabetes, they may well be rejected. And I think part of the goals is to not only learn about the stem cells, but also the immune response to that.
Dr. Rafat, you agree?
I would agree, and I would also agree that, for instance, if you talk about a disease like Parkinson's, we actually don't understand why individuals do get Parkinson's, and even though we may be able to replace the cells, if that's for a long enough period of time, it is theoretically possible at whatever cost in the beginning to develop Parkinson's may actually show back up. Mm-hmm. And so I think time will need to tell.
1-800-989-825 is our number. Let's go to the phones. And is it Brahma in Chico, California?
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, my question is, I'm a retired professor of chemistry. The basic research, I do not understand why scientists allow themselves to be browbeaten by the dictum of morality of politicians.
You want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, the question is, all basic research has two sides. It can be misused and can be well used. Technology is an entirely different issue. So in my opinion, the scientists themselves have created the problem by allowing these politicians to debate us when they know nothing about science.
Ah. There's a sticky wicket.
Ira?
Yes, Dr.
Maybe
Kai, go ahead. This time you jumped in.
I didn't
even ask you. So go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that there's a grain of truth in what the caller is saying, and I think we, in a way, have missed the boat. You know, politicians have different reasons for voting the way they do or making policy the way they do than scientists might agree with or disagree with. And so I think we should be clear about what's going on when it's a political decision versus one that's about science or even about ethics. And I think that this debate has really been hijacked by politics in large part. I don't think that the scientific community has sort of stood by and let that happen. There's been a lot of discussion, a lot of debate, a lot of testifying before Congress about why we should go forward with certain kinds of embryonic stem cell research. It just needs to fall on ears that are receptive to hearing what they have to say. Personally, I think that a lot of this will change when we have the first real sense of therapeutic benefit. So both Dan and Catherine were talking about Parkinson's, and we can look at an example from history of changes in policy around federal use of federal dollars for fetal tissue research, which was restricted just as it is now in embryo research until about 1993, and what changed that sense that the principle was we couldn't use federal money for research on discarded human fetal tissue, just like we say we can't use that money for human embryo research. It all changed when there was a sense that Parkinson's research using that fetal tissue could actually benefit real, sick, actual patients. And I think it's very easy to stand by principle when there's sort of nothing on the other side pushing, no obvious therapeutic benefit. And when we see the first real breakthroughs in the sense that real people can be helped by embryonic stem cell research, that a lot of the barriers to using human embryos will fall down.
So once we get some tangible results, people are going to say, what are you waiting for now? You know, where are you?
Right.
Well, especially
and in the face of that, that evidence, I think politicians will have a very hard time sticking by what has been effectively a theoretical principle or at least a political line rather than one that has anything to do with ethics or with, you know, what could actually be beneficial treatment for real sick patients. And I think that's why people like Michael J. Fox going before Congress talking about Parkinson's disease or Christopher Reeves talking about spinal cord regeneration is very effective. It's real people with real disease who are arguing that they can get real help. I think the evidence is not quite there yet that they can get real help, but when that comes through, then it will be very hard in the face of that to restrict the use of human embryos.
And it's interesting to watch the politics of this because you have lined up on one side of the issue people who have who are affected in their personal lives, some of the most conservative people in Congress who are in favor of stem cell research because they have relatives, children, or whatever, who could benefit from this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it doesn't line up along the lines of, at least strictly speaking, abortion politics. So people who are very conservative on abortion are actually quite liberal and permissive when it comes to stem cell research. People like Orrin Hatch come to mind.
Mm-hmm. Talking about stem cell research this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Do you think that scientists need to be more vocal, like our caller was saying? You know, do you feel browbeaten, panelists, by Dr. Verfey? Do you feel?
I've been felt misused to a large extent by some politicians who've actually not even spoken to me. And even though my research relates to adult stem cells, I've always been very outspoken. That this doesn't mean that we stop embryonic stem cell research, and that we should go forward with both of them. I think the call is to some extent maybe a little right that we don't necessarily all the time go out of our way to go talk to politicians and the public, but I think it is really a matter of trying to educate the public as well as the politicians as long as they're willing to listen to what we have to say, which may not always be the case, and they may have selective ears to hear certain parts of what one says and not the other parts.
I think it's very difficult to ever change anybody's mind about anything. Dr. Vuk Pavlovich, you agree with
I think it's impossible. There is an old adage that scientific theories die with their proponents if they are wrong. So as long as so I think we, in a way, we have to wait for the new generation for whom this syntagm, embryonic stem cells, sounds normal, so that who have been brought up in schools and everywhere with that as a fact of life, and then it will probably ease, and as well with success in therapeutic successes, there is no doubt about it.
Dr. Kaufman?
Well, I think people's minds maybe can't be changed, but they can be educated, and I think that's what we're talking about here. And people might have misperceptions about what embryonic stem cells are and where they come from. Once you explain that these are almost all these cell lines are leftovers from in vitro fertilization clinics and would be discarded if not used for scientific research, and that couples volunteer to donate these blastocysts or embryos for research purposes, most people I've talked to who might have been against this now support it once they're educated and can understand what we're dealing with.
But if you believe that life begins at conception, it doesn't matter what you tell anybody, does it? People believe that.
For those people, I then try and clarify what we should be doing with the in vitro fertilization clinics, which do create life. 1 million people have been born through the process of IVF, but you can't do IVF without creating leftover embryos. And we have to, those embryos are either going to be discarded or they can be used for research. And if you begin, if you believe strongly that life begins at conception, then we shouldn't be doing in vitro fertilization therapies for couples who are otherwise infertile.
Dr. Verfa, any last word on it?
No, I think I totally agree with that.
And I've always found, and I, you know, that it, we talked before about changing opinions, that if and when you get the first real therapy that works, and if it comes from a line of stem cells that was not authorized, imagine what people are going to say, you know. Especially if it comes from overseas where people have, are working on it because they were forced to go over there if that happens because there was no stem cells to work from here. And it's been said many times to me on our program, the dam will break, you know, it will break and people will accept it, Dr. Khan, like you say.
Well, I think that that's right. And I also think that there's this sense that new technologies are often met with some sense that there's a yuck factor, or, you know, because we're unsure about it. It's new, it's different, we've never seen it before. We can look at the history of organ transplant as being a case like that, where heart transplant, when it first was proposed and then carried out, people were quite shocked by. But now we don't have enough organs to do all the transplants we want to do. So over time, we become not only used to it, but we seek out the use of those technologies and try to find ways to do to use them more. So I think that that will be the history with this technology as well. And the good news is we don't have to all agree. We live in a pluralistic society, and it's not driven by total consensus. We have a majority rule kind of government, and I think we have to ask whether our politicians are in sync with what the majority view is on these issues.
All right, you've got the last word. I'd like to thank all of my guests. Jeff Khan is director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Minnesota, Stanimir Vuk Pavlovich, director of the Stem Cell Laboratory and professor of biochemistry and molecular biology at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine in Rochester, Minnesota, Dan Kaufman, assistant professor at the Stem Cell Institute and in the Department of Medicine at University of Minnesota, and Catherine Verfey, director of the Stem Cell Institute and professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota. Thank you all for taking time to talk with us today. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick in New York, Chris Nelson in St. Paul, Suzanne Herron, Mitch Eaton, and Vince Muse in Washington. Thanks also to Don O'Connor and Mark Reinfleisch at the Science Museum of Minnesota for their technical assistance. Greg Smith composed our theme music. If you have comments or questions or you missed any of the topics we talk about, you want to know more about them, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Also, you can go there and get free teaching materials on Science Friday's Kids Connection. They're there for your taking. Also, you can listen on Real Audio or download them on your audio, audible.com player, back issues of Science Friday. We had a great time in St. Paul. I want to thank the city of St. Paul and everybody here in the audience. Thank you for showing up here in the Science Museum of Minnesota. We'll see you next week in New York. I'm Ira Flatow in St. Paul.